The recording has started.
Great, thank you. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. Welcome to the IGO-INGO Curative Rights Protection PDP Working Group meeting on the 12th of May at 1600 UTC. On the call today, we have Philip Corwin, George Kirikos, Jay Chapman, Paul Tattersfield. We do have apologies from Peter Renforth, Osvaldo Novoa, and Mason Cole. And from staff, we have Steve Chan, Barry Cobb, Mary Wong, and myself, Michelle Duesmeyer. I'd like to remind you all to please state your name before speaking for transcription purposes. Thank you. I'd like to turn the call over to Philip Corwin at this time.
Well, greetings, everyone, whatever time of day it is where you're calling in from. Phil Corwin here. We don't have a detailed agenda today. We're just going to continue our discussion of Professor Swain's memo in preparation for a call next week in which we expect him to join us. I supplied some thoughts, questions, and comments regarding his memo. I distributed that late yesterday to the group. I know George Kirikos did something similar. We got some limited comments from Paul Keating, who's not able to join us today. Hopefully some of you, even if you didn't provide anything in writing, have thought about his memo some more. May I ask staff, I see this Adobe presenter. Are we having a PowerPoint going on? Because I wasn't aware of any. What is that about?
No. I can go ahead and clear that out if you'd like.
Okay. Yeah. It's just kind of distracting. I didn't know if there was a PowerPoint we didn't know about. So the way I propose to handle this is, you know, George and I are the ones who provided extensive comments. Paul Keating's comment related to he thought there should be more attention to the contract issue, which I think would probably relate more to the waiver issue and whether it was voluntary or involuntary and proper or improper. But why don't we I don't think we have to review everything said in those written memos, but I'd suggest maybe you start out, George, with what you think was a key point you raised, and then I'll switch to me, and we can have people chime in on that or add other issues and see how much time that takes. But just go through these points and to help. Mary, you put them all in a single document. Okay, so let me, that's the document on display now? Okay, so why don't we do this, George, rather than jumping back and forth, it's 12:05, why don't we go through some of what you think is most important in your comments, not every one, we all have the written document. Let's do that for 10, 15 minutes and switch over, then look at Paul Keating's and switch over to mine, and then see how long that all takes, and just have a discussion among the group that's on the call today. Is that an acceptable format for handling this call? Any objections?
George Kirikos here for the transcript. Given that we've all, you and I have already submitted written comments, I was wondering maybe if Jay or Paul Tattersfield, who are on the call, might want to go first if they have any written, sorry, if they have any oral observations that they might want to share before we go through our written ones.
Sure, I think that's a good suggestion. And why don't we, Jay or Paul Tattersfield, if you want to speak at this time, just raise your hand and we'll call on you. Oh, and by the way, while we're waiting, Michelle, there was no one on the phone line, not in the chat room, was there?
No.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm not seeing any hands raised from Jay or Paul, so George, why don't you get into yours, and then we'll invite their comments as we go along.
Okay. George Kirikos speaking again. I guess the concern I had the most was I guess I numbered it question B1, which was the issue where he tried to isolate an issue, and I kind of disagreed that the thought experiment that he took that he made didn't actually isolate the question by focusing on one because of the asymmetry. So he said that legitimate expectations of the IGOs could be isolated if you look at what would happen in the one scenario, but it's not the same if they're the ones initiating a court case. So I think that was a kind of a very, very big issue. I don't know if people, well, they see it on the screen, but if people had any comments on that, I'd appreciate it if they shared that concern.
Okay, give me a moment here, George, as I read through, because the memo and the comments, none of them are simple.
Right. He said that he would imagine that scenario, that it isolates the question as to whether an IGO has a legitimate expectation that it would be entitled to immunity absent the UDRP. And the scenario he gave, though, doesn't properly isolate that question, because if the UDRP didn't exist, then an IGO going to court would necessarily waive their immunity. So what he wrote in his paper wasn't useful at all, because he was looking at it as only the immunity only exists as a defense mechanism to an action brought by somebody else. And so he thought, I'll isolate this defense mechanism and say, do the IGOs have an expectation of immunity? But that's not what would happen absent the UDRP. Absent the UDRP, they'd be initiating some action in court, and so they wouldn't have any legitimate expectation of immunity, because it's no longer a defense to an action that somebody else brought. It's an action that they brought in court. So that was my big issue with what I numbered as B1, and you have to go back to page 8 of his written paper. He didn't number the paragraphs, which was kind of a bit hard to cite every text that he used. But it's the top of page 8.
Right. Right. Yeah, I think that's certainly something that we can respectfully bring up with him next week when he's on the call. I get your point. In the absence of the UDRP, the only way the IGO could directly litigate would be to bring a court action, which would involve a waiver right up front. There is a possibility they could appoint an agent to bring it on their behalf, and as he discusses in the paper, that might be accepted in some jurisdictions and not in others. If they were accused of infringement, they could try to assert the immunity defense in a court situation. I think that's a legitimate comment, and we can raise it with him on the call next week, see what his response is.
Yeah. George Kirkus here again. I consider it important because he actually wrote on page 8, if such immunity is minimal or uncertain, then any compromises required by the UDRP loom less large. So that's why, if the principal scenario is that there's no expectation of immunity, then UDRP is fine as it is. It argues for the status quo. And if you jump to page 23, which I mentioned on on point B1, he actually, mentions that scenario of them going to court and, not expecting immunity. So I was kind of perplexed that he had that, different statement on page 8. We could talk about some of the other points I raised, but that was, I think, the most important one, because it really argued for the status quo. And I guess if we look at the other examples on B2, I talk about various scenarios where even if the immunity existed for the IGO against the registrant, the registrant can still do other things like doing the going after the registrar, going after ICANN, going after the domain name itself. Like that, you do have this concept of in rem lawsuits to go after the property itself, and the fact that there's also the immunity aspect in the registration agreements that being the registrant of a domain name has a waiver of immunity because, people are, specifying the jurisdiction for lawsuits, et cetera.
Right.
So, you know, if we actually made any changes, we'd actually have to recommend that the RIA be renegotiated, that all the registrars would need to agree to new things, which they may or may not want to do. We don't have any registrars present on the call, but I know that the RIA negotiations were, you know, quite stressful from, you know, and long, you know, long-standing, so I don't think that one could trivially insert changes to it without it having to be renegotiated in full.
Yeah. Phil here, I think, you know, if this working group were to reach any conclusion that for any class of IGO, some alternative appeals process was required or advisable, I think we've already had some discussion that we would not undertake to establish that new policy. We would simply recommend that and note what additional changes would be involved, which if it would also require RIA changes, you know, it would obviously require an exception in the UDRP. It would require the creation of a whole new, possibly an agreement, an alternative to the UDRP. It would require a designation of a alternative dispute resolution provider. It could would probably require RIA changes. So it, I think that's as far as we would go. We're not contemplating actually, even in the event that we were to reach that conclusion, to create that whole new system. I think we discharge our duty with our final report and recommendations.
George Krikos speaking again. I noticed that Nat Cohen joined the chat room. I don't know if he's on the call itself, but I'd be happy to give up some time to him if he had any comments before talking about the written comments that I have.
Yeah. Phil here, and welcome, Matt. Are you on the phone line, Matt?
Yeah.
Oh, he's just... Okay. Well, if you want, what we did before you got on, we're discussing some of the comments put in writing by myself, George, and Paul Keating. Not all of them, just the most important. We gave Jay and Paul a chance to speak at the beginning of the discussion. If they had any particular point they wanted to raise, and we extend the same courtesy to you now, or of course you're free to chime in at any point during the discussion. So did you have anything in particular you'd like to say now, Nat, or if not, we'll just proceed as we're doing?
Thanks very much. Now I was just going to just listen in.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. George Krikos speaking again. B3 was, I guess, the question of alternative mechanisms beyond the ones that he mentioned himself. And the example I gave really has to go with, you know, who has standing to bring a UDRP. We know that the trademark holder or the mark holder has standing, and we kind of agree that somebody that's in the Article 6 TER database would likely have standing to bring it. We've seen examples where that right can be assigned to the law firm. That's the example that the professor considered that we'd brought up previously in the working group. But then would law enforcement or an attorney general have standing to bring? Conceivably, that's something that a UDRP panel might consider, or, you know, we might want to consider that as a solution, because I think it would definitely solve the problem of immunity. Because let's say, to give an example where I'm in Ontario, Canada, if the Ontario or the federal authorities in Canada saw that there's a registrant who's, you know, violating the marks of the World Bank or UNESCO or whatever, let's say it wasn't for domain names, it was for something else, conceivably they would sue that person in court, you know, either criminal or civil court, to get them to stop what they're doing. And so it wouldn't be a great leap or extension to say that, you know, they could use the UDRP as an alternative dispute resolution mechanism compared to the courts. And because the attorney general or the authorities are obviously in the same country as a registrant, an appeal to that of a UDRP decision to the courts wouldn't have any issue with doing that.
Yeah, George, Phil here. Let me respond on that. On the issue of standing, this group has already reached a preliminary conclusion that IGOs, which have asserted their protective rights under Article 60 of the Paris Convention should have standing, and we're probably going to recommend clarification of that for UDRP filing purposes. We could also consider whether we would recommend clarifying that an IGO can appoint a private counsel, another party, its agent or assignee, to bring a UDRP on its own behalf. That's something we can consider, and that would be an advantage over a court filing, because as the memo discusses, not all courts would recognize such an assignment. It's dicey on that. Speaking as a matter of first impression, just speaking myself, I'd be somewhat reluctant to permit any prosecutor or law enforcement agency of any nation in the world to assert rights on behalf of any IGO. If the IGO requested, they'd be it would almost be a waiver of immunity, because they'd be asking a national law enforcement official to assert their rights. And if they didn't, I'd be a little concerned about letting law enforcement have that independently. We can discuss that further, but that's an initial reaction on my part.
George Grieco speaking. Yes, I agree that, they're very, important safeguards that would have to be in place, and it's not necessarily something that we would want to do, but I just put it out there as a thought experiment, because we have seen law enforcement and government authorities just unilaterally seize various domain names for copyright infringement or counterfeiting and other things. We've seen that happen time and time again. It's very controversial when they do, and it's not even clear that they've gone to the courts to do that. So the UDRP and lawsuit, the courts in general, it's all about due process, and there'd have to be, safeguards in place if we did make that extension. And, I don't think that there's any consensus that we would want to do that, but I wanted to throw that out there because he was putting in, binding arbitration and other things that, something that a registrant wouldn't agree to, but court actions by authorities is something that does exist. If their alternative was to do a UDRP instead, the registrant might be amenable to that.
Yeah, but Phil, again, there's been a lot of criticism of cases where agencies have just seized domains by in-camera court order, and I can imagine a scenario where there might be a criticism website that incorporates the name of an IGO and is criticizing the fact that certain governments are participating in it, where a law enforcement agency of one of those governments brings a action in one of its own national courts to seize that domain name or to initiate a UDRP against that domain name, without even consulting with the IGO. So we're going to have to look at that idea more closely, even as a thought experiment.
George Kirkus speaking again, looking at Mary's comment in the chat, I didn't say that this would be something that they would want to compel IGOs to make that kind of assignment. This would be some option. If, immunity was such a grave concern to them, then, it would be an alternative, tool that they could use, just like they already have the existing tool of assigning things to a law firm, in the example that's already on the record, because, even the UDRP itself is just another tool, an alternative to the court, and I think we saw from the State Department letter that the existence of, the ability to go to court in itself should be sufficient to satisfy the obligations that the states have under their Article 6 treaty obligations. Just to jump to the other points I made in the written comments before, just looking for specific examples where.
Yeah, George, could you just note which one on which page you're discussing?
B4
is on them.
Page 4. Page 4 of the 6 pages.
Page 4. Which point?
I labeled it 4. It says starting while the professor provides examples where parties entering into a contract with an IGO.
On page 4 of your document? Are you looking at the document on the screen?
On the document on the screen, it would be 1, 2.
Yeah, let's refer to that one for
pages. It would be on page 3, the bottom of page 3. Sorry about that. I printed it out on my own printer. He gave the example of Apple entering into a contract with IGOs, you know, offering various, you know, arbitration mechanisms. He hasn't really provided an example, though, of, you know, totally unrelated third parties entering into arbitration on a compelled basis simply because an IGO wants it to be arbitration. So if he has any examples of that, because that's what we're really asking. We're asking for registrants who have a right to go to national courts, giving up that right in a compelled manner, and having it decided by binding arbitration against their will. And so if he has examples of that, where it's occurred, I'd love to see it.
Yeah, they may not exist given the uniqueness of the UDRP, which
right.
is kind of a trilateral arrangement, not a bilateral contract.
All right, I gave the example if somebody was selling, for George speaking again, of UNESCO or World Bank cookies or things like that, where there's clear and obvious trademark infringement. If they're somehow able to compel that infringer to go to some United Nations tribunal rather than their own national courts, I'd love to see the mechanism where he believes that that has happened anywhere in history. Because immunity is really just a shield, from what I understand. You know, it's a defense to an action. It's not something where the IGO is, you know, initiating the action, but somehow dictating, you know, what the venue that it's going to be decided in. That's really the crux of, you know, the immunity issue.
Yeah. Well, that's just axiomatic. Obviously, if a IGO is the plaintiff and not a defendant, it's decided to go into court and it's essentially waived its immunity.
Yeah. And then I think the rest of the document that I submitted was more about, you know, general comments and takeaways. I did have some issues with some of the non-neutral language, which Paul Keating mentioned as well. And so I don't want to take up any more time. If anybody had any specific questions, I'd be happy to elaborate, but I'm free to give up my time to you and anybody else who wants to make comments or suggestions.
Okay. Well, thank you, George, and we thank you for the obviously the considerable time you put into writing up those thoughts. I'll take the liberty to read Paul Keating. You raised the non-neutral language. Unless, you know, it's the professor's memo. I think the legal analysis is pretty neutral and isn't slanted one way or the other. He tries to look at both sides or all three sides of every issue. And George, Paul, George, in your comment, if you scroll on the screen to page 5, you'll see Paul Keating's comments. It's all there in one single document. Mary's combined it. This is a combined single document that she's created for us. So my own view on the non-neutral language is that it's the professor's memo, and I don't find it, you know, overall to be biased. I think it's factually, it's an excellent memo for our purposes, and we know more than we ever wanted to know about IGO sovereign immunity from reading it. Having disposed at least my comments, and anyone can raise their hand and speak up on any of this as we go along, and I'll stop talking and defer to them. On Paul's first comment, he thought there should be some analysis of contractual analysis that the UDRP exists as a matter of contract. A registrant agrees to it to be bound by it when they register a domain, and that includes the mutual jurisdiction language, and that kind of writing in some form kind of immunity after the fact might render the entire registration agreement, or at least the part pertaining the UDRP, open to invalidation. And Mary, I see you have a comment. I'll get to that in a second. I think that's a point worth considering if we ever decide that in any case it would be, incumbent to recognize the immunity of some class of IGOs and to create an alternative appeals process. We'd have to decide when that would become binding on the registrant. The registrant has agreed to a particular contract when they registered their domain. If they've, can that just be imposed on them after the fact? And I guess think again, this points out that we'd probably need some modification of the RAA to recognize all this, and some notice process to registrants that this has now been changed. I don't know if those contracts bind registrants to any future changes in the contract or in the UDRP. They probably bind them to changes in consensus policy, which would include, I think, the RAA. But I'll stop there. Mary's question was whether any comments or questions I don't think need to go to Professor Swain. I don't want to play the editing role in saying this particular comment isn't worthy of going to him. I think it's fine to, he's an adult. He's a professional. These are all meant to, he's used to the Socratic method and to questioning in law school classes and looking at things from every angle. So I don't think he'll be offended in any way. I didn't see any question that I thought was disrespectful or lacked any merit. So that would be my personal view. George, you have your hand up.
George Perico speaking. Thanks, Phil. I'd agree with you on that point that you just made. I had a different point I wanted to make with regards to Paul's statement. If we actually did make a change, which I'm saying we are going to make any changes, one thing we might have to do is, because of that point that Paul Keating raises, is that existing domain name registrants might have to be grandfathered in that, there'd have to be some list of IGO names where any binding arbitration would only apply to a specific set of examples. For example, we have the reserved list that IGOs have for the new GTLDs. There's a list of, 100 and something domain names. In case that there's a domain name or registrant change, the new owner might have to be on notice because of that list that these names in particular, would be subject to binding arbitration if they're misused in a certain way. But to change it, in the middle of the game, so to speak, without proper notice would be unfair to existing registrants. So that's, I think, something that, from what I read of Paul Keating's statement, is something that, we might have to consider. Like a grandfathering mechanism plus a full notification period of the specific domain names that they are concerned about.
Thank you, George. And Phil speaking again. Yeah, clearly if we ever get to that point, we'd have to think about how you do this transition legally. You've got a registrant who's agreed to a contract that says that if they're accused of infringement, they can be the respondent in a UDRP action. And that if they're not happy with the decision, they have a right to appeal to a court of mutual jurisdiction on a de novo basis. And if that policy were to change, I think as a legal matter, contractually, they'd have to there'd have to be some process to bind them to the new change and to put the registrars on notice of that change and have them rewrite their agreements to reflect it. So all of that would take time. There'd have to be a transition. It might be triggered when a domain name is renewed, but if you got one that's renewed for the full 10-year maximum period, could you impose that in the midst of that 10-year period when the contract that was agreed to at the time of the 10-year registration had nothing about IGO immunity? So those are all questions we'd have to deal with if we get to that point. Also, one thing that just occurred to me in this discussion, and anyone on this list, including staff, can disagree, but I think we're at the point now where this working group is really not contemplating Well, as I said, we wouldn't write it, but we're not, I don't think, believe we're contemplating recommending an entirely new curative rights process created solely for IGOs to file complaints. I think we've narrowed this down to whether certain classes of IGOs should have an alternative appeals process from a UDRP. And I'll stop there, and if anyone thinks that wasn't clear, please ask a question, or if anyone disagrees, please ask a question. But I think we've agreed the sovereign immunity issue, which is the only reason for any change in the current system, only arises in the very narrow circumstance of an appeal from a UDRP decision.
George here. I don't think that's 100% correct, because the respondent in a UDRP, the domain name owner, can file a lawsuit during the UDRP before the panel makes its decision. That's exactly the scenario of the case that my company was involved in Pupa.com. We filed a lawsuit in Ontario court during the UDRP itself, and the panel, you know, deferred its judgment to the courts. So there wasn't any, you know, UDRP decision to necessarily appeal from. It was just deferred entirely to the courts.
Okay. Yeah, good point, George. And when I say appeal, I mean initiation of a legal action, which, as you point out, the respondent is always free at any point during a UDRP to file a lawsuit, and panels are split on whether the UDRP should stop at that point or whether the panel is still free to continue and reach a decision when a lawsuit is filed in the midst of a UDRP. Okay. Yeah, and technically it's not a, well, we call it an appeal because we don't have a very clear alternative word for designating the situation where one of the parties to a UDRP is unhappy with the result and wants a de novo court review. That's what we mean when we call when we refer to something as an appeal from a UDRP. Hold on one second. I'm just going to take a sip of water. Excuse me. Okay, thank you. And George, I note Jay's comment in the chat room. I note Mary's comment that we could differentiate between the types of IGOs. Clearly, the UN agencies have the strongest claim to immunity based on the memo. The claim of the other organizations is varies from organization to organization, depending on lots of different circumstances. And noting also Mary's comment that any changes to the system could be implemented, not necessarily would require consensus policy, but would certainly require contractual changes in the RAA. And George asked whether we know if the IGOs are planning to give feedback to the Swain report. I believe they've received that now. They and the GAC have received it, and we've invited their feedback. I don't know. Mary indicated we don't know if they're going to continue to pretty much not be responsive to this group. So we'll now proceed to the questions and comments I provided. There's no need to go through all of them. I think, let me, as I scroll, I'll just get into the ones. Okay. Yeah. Under item 2 on page 6 of the combined memo, I asked a question, which we can explore with the professor next week, about whether the jurisdiction in which the IGO is chosen to be domiciled if it affords IGOs absolute immunity, whether that would have any bearing on our considerations. And I also noted, relevant question under item 3 there, 3A, scope of IGO immunity and varied basis for the immunity. I asked, I think this is a quite a relevant question. Others can agree or disagree. We've got, ICANN is a U.S. government creation. It's a non-California nonprofit corporation subject to California and U.S. law. The United States has not ratified the convention on the privileges and immunities of the specialized agencies, which is the one that gives the UN agencies heightened immunity in other parts of the world to some extent, and instead has passed its own law on that subject. So whether the fact that the UDRP is a creation of a U.S.-based nonprofit corporation should be factored into our consideration. I'm just going to click through these as the ones I think are important, and if anyone has any comments at any point, raise your hand. If not, I see some stuff in the chat room. We'll get back to all of that when I complete this quick review. I did note that UN-affiliated IGOs are differentiated from other IGOs as a matter of law. I noted in the discussion that in terms of restrictive immunity, which is the view adopted by some U.S. courts, that immunity gets less favor when the dispute relates to a commercial matter, and trademark disputes are generally viewed as commercial matter, trademark being a species of commercial law, although later in the memo I noted that Professor Swain said that there might be some argument that defense of an IGO's name related to one of its core functions. And, of course, we've got the waiver issue, which whether by choosing the UDRP route, the IGO is effectively waiving it. Of course, we can argue about whether that waiver is voluntary or involuntary. Comment on functional immunity, but that's not one regarded as by U.S. courts, but we don't know what particular court an appeal from a UDRP would wind up in, particularly with the now that we have all the new TLDs, which are based all around the world. Okay, I thought his discussion, this moving on to the waiver of immunity, beginning on page 7 into page 8, my own view was that the benefits of access to the UDRP process, which is a low-cost and rapid resolution, in my view, would outweigh the potential costs, including the potential waiver of immunity on appeal, to engaging for an IGO engaging in a UDRP. Okay, and then at the page of page 9, top of page 8, I thought his discussion was helpful in making clear that ICANN's requirement of acceding to an appeal to a court of mutual jurisdiction couldn't be compared to state-mandated duress against an IGO, that it was more of a voluntary waiver. And you can read the rest of that, but it seems to weigh in favor of being not so troubled by the waiver of immunity required of an IGO entering into initiating UDRP action. Finally, on the alternatives, beginning on page 8, Yeah, I thought this was helpful in maintaining the status quo discussion, where he said that, you know, affording them a means of surrendering that immunity via mutual jurisdiction provision is not a direct infringement of their immunity, that the current UDRP, as it's constructed, is not an infringement, and that he said it was unlikely that the mutual jurisdiction concession establishes or occasions for a violation of IGO immunity. And the conclusion I drew from that was that what's before this group is we're not confronted with a clear violation of any legal principle, and therefore we have more discretion because what we're really debating is a policy issue and whether it's proper to have the IGO consent to that waiver of immunity and the possible circumstance of an appeal to a court of mutual jurisdiction by initiating an IGO. I thought that was a very important point that he made. And then he talked about designating an assignee or agent, and I talked earlier about that might be something we'd want to recognize as having that assignee or agent having standing, that there be no question about them having standing to initiate the UDRP on behalf of the IGO, which would be a way for the IGO to isolate itself. We can't control whether the court of mutual jurisdiction would recognize the assignee or agent in the appeal, but that's something beyond our powers. And wrapping up on page 9, I'm a little concerned about the notion of UNCITRAL being the designated arbitration agency, if we ever were to go that route, and saying there's an alternative arbitration forum, not a court forum for appeals, based on the fact that UNCITRAL is itself, and again, it's UNCITRAL, is a UN agency, so you have to question whether there'd be some bias on behalf of other UN agencies in an appeal situation. And wrapping up, on the last point, item 3 on page 9, he proposed illustrative model language from what might be inserted as provision in the UDRP to provide an alternative jurisdiction for IGOs, and I think his very language illustrates kind of the conundrum we're faced with in all of this. The clause in that which says that except that in the event the action depends on the adjudication of the rights of an IGO, that would, but for this provision, be entitled to immunity from such judicial process according to the law applicable in that jurisdiction as established by a decision of a court in that jurisdiction. Well, the problem is there's probably no jurisdiction in the world that's ever decided on whether an IGO has immunity in an appeal situation in a UDRP. So it would be a de novo determination in just about every jurisdiction. And so you get to the situation where in trying to shield IGOs from being exposed to a court decision, you would throw the ultimate question of their immunity into a national court of mutual jurisdiction. So it makes it very hard to escape getting courts involved. And for our own purposes, it's very unclear. The UN agencies would have the strongest claim to immunity, but the fact is that we couldn't stop respondents from independently trying to assert a right and initiating a lawsuit in which they tried to block that alternative arbitration, and we have no idea how that, you know, request for intervention against the transfer of their domain would be adjudicated. And in fact, in the United States, depending on which appeals court circuit you're in, the result might be different. So it's very difficult to decide which IGOs have immunity for what's essentially a trademark infringement action in an arbitration situation without asking the court whether they have immunity for that purpose. So you wind right back up in court on the immunity question. And his final suggestion that if an IGO elects arbitration, they should bear the cost for the respondent. My own observation is that would probably not be welcome by the GAC or the small IGO group, given that they've already advised us that they want an alternative process, which is either free or at very nominal cost, though they haven't identified what threshold would be the limits of nominal cost. So I'll stop there, and let's see what comments we've gotten. Yeah, George, go ahead and comment orally while I'm reviewing the chat room.
George Grigel speaking for the transcript. I want to echo the good point you made with regards to the UNCITRAL arbitration. It kind of echoes my own comments on page 4 of this document, which I numbered C1, where the merits of an action are going to be quite different in different jurisdictions. That was a point that the professor himself made, and the results will vary, of course, by jurisdiction. And I think that was one of the most important statements that he put in the document, an important takeaway, because if we take this instead out of the hands of the courts and into a UN arbitration, we don't know how that arbitration will even be held. I was reading the UNCITRAL rules, which are about 30 pages long on their website, and I'm not even sure that they offer all the due process protections that exist in real courts. Like, would they be able to subpoena witnesses? A real court could subpoena witnesses. There could be discovery of documents where people are compelled to produce evidence that's, not the evidence that they voluntarily submit to a court, but, that they're compelled to comport that, to compelled to produce that might be against their narrative that's detrimental to their case. So we have, an adversarial court system, at least in Canada and the United States, which has due process protections to try to get at all the facts. And I'm not sure that, an arbitration will even have those protections. In Canada and the United States, if you lie in court, you're subject to perjury. In an arbitration, you can basically lie with impunity, because what can an arbitrator do? they have no authority against, people who perjure themselves. Whereas, you can go to jail if the perjury is high enough. So,
yeah. Well, thank you, George. And I'm going to get to you in one second. I just noting Paul's comment in the chat room. Certainly next week when we're on the phone with the professor, we can ask him if he knows of any alternatives to UNCITRAL that IGOs might find acceptable. I was personally surprised, and I assume it's based on some knowledge of the UNCITRAL process, by his view that an UNCITRAL arbitration could be more expensive than even judicial litigation, knowing what the costs of litigation are, which is why he suggested the cost burden be placed on the IGO. Mary, why don't you go ahead and speak up?
Sure. Thanks, Phil, and everybody. So I just wanted to go back to the UNCITRAL rules issue, and not so much to educate this group, because I think you already know, but just to put it on the record for others who may be reading the transcript or listening to the recording of this call after the fact, that for the UNCITRAL rules to apply, like with many rules of arbitration, the parties to the dispute first have to agree to the application or the applicability of those rules, whether through an arbitration agreement or after the dispute has arisen. One potential benefit of the UNCITRAL rules is that they do apply to a wide variety of international commercial disputes. What we don't know, I think, as I noted in an email, and I know, Phil, you replied to that, is the match of that kind of scope with domain name disputes. Secondly, in terms of the application of the UNCITRAL rules, it probably is not so much the fact that UNCITRAL is a UN body, because the place of arbitration for applying the UNCITRAL rules, you know, could be a number of different venues, whether it be London, Singapore, or anything like that. So the point here, I think, is that, and as I said to Paul in the chat, there are various options, such as the ICC rules, which many of which actually are similar to the UNCITRAL rules in terms of just general applicability and principles, but they do require an agreement to have an arbitration subject to that, and then you get into things about the place of arbitration and the fit of those rules. And then the question as to cost, I mean, certainly some of these could prove quite costly, because simply the fact that an arbitration is an alternative to litigation, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it is always cheaper or you know, less complex, because an arbitration under any of these sets of rules would be a binding decision on the parties that agreed to it. Thanks, Phil.
Okay. Thank you, Mary, for your always excellent interventions, supplying us with additional knowledge. George, I see your hand up.
George Crickle speaking again. You know, maybe I didn't make my point very well earlier, but I guess my concern was that either under UNCITRAL or the ICC or any other arbitration, whether they can actually produce the same result that would have happened in a national court. Like, under, you know, would the UNCITRAL panelists be equivalent to a Canadian judge who would know, for example, all the Canadian laws and all the Canadian defenses that are available to them, or would they be applying some other legal standard? I think that's the concern for a registrant, that they would want to have available to them all the same protections that they would under their own national laws to get to the same verdict. And I'm not sure that that would be the case. I think if it went to arbitration, both sides would have to agree on what laws apply and what the appropriate legal test is. And that's what you kind of get when you have some commercial contract, say, between, you know, Microsoft and an IGO or a UN nation agency or whatever, which I don't think you necessarily have under the UDRP, because the UDRP, you know, gave a, you know, a simple three-prong test, and it gave, you know, a specific remedy, you know, either transfer of the domain name or cancellation. I think in a real court of law, you know, you'd get a wide variety of possible outcomes. You could have, you know, the transfer of the domain and the cancellation, but you could also have, you know, money damages. You could have an agreement to, you know, stop doing the infringing action, but not transfer the domain name. So it's not clear that, to me, that you're going to get the same outcome as the national courts. And from my perspective, you know, the national judges of those national courts are in a better position than some other arbitrator to make that decision.
Okay, Phil here. Thank you, George. We're 4 minutes from the top of the hour. Did anyone else have anything they want to say as we near the conclusion of this call? Okay, well, let me just say in closing, these are personal views. I think overall, you know, I might have some quibbles with the shading of some language in the professor's memo, but overall I think it's an excellent document that is very well informed. This working group, in as clear a manner as such a complicated subject can be described as to the present state of the law on IGO immunity. My own personal conclusions at this point are one, I think this working group is now probably not looking at the possibility of creating an entirely new curative rights processes for all IGOs. What we're looking at is whether there should be an alternative appeals process from a UDRP decision for some class of IGOs that we believe has such a strong claim to immunity that they deserve it. Other key takeaways from the memo for me was that the existing UDRP policy of having an appeal to a court of mutual jurisdiction does not impinge on any legal rights. We're not compelled to change it. What we're dealing with a policy question rather than a question of legal compulsion, and that while UN agencies have the strongest claim to immunity, even for them in the context of a trademark decision, which can be characterized as a commercial dispute, not necessarily within the framework of their core functions, that it's, if we ask different courts around the world or even within discrete nations whether that particular dispute is deserving of sovereign immunity, we would get very different answers depending on the forum, which makes it difficult for us to create some universal rule for any class of IGOs. So I'll stop there. Those are my own personal thoughts. And, yeah, Mary's had a conversation with George back and forth in the chat about UNCTAD trial versus court decision. And George asked about Professor Swain. My understanding, and staff can correct me if I'm wrong, is that we do have a pretty good commitment from Professor Swain to join our call next week and engage in a dialogue and answer questions. So that's all I had to say. Does anyone else have anything they want to raise before we adjourn the call at 12:59 Eastern Time?
George, are we going to get anything written from Professor Swain before next week? And also, you know, will we get anything from the IGOs? Like maybe the IGOs should be invited to next week's call to participate because we haven't really heard from them through the 2 years of our work.
Yeah, as chair, as co-chair, I have no objection to inviting, you know, IGO representatives. Always been free to join this group. They've chosen not to, but we can make them aware. I have no problem with the staff sending out a notice to the chair of the GAC and to the IGO small group that we're going to have this dialogue with Professor Swain. They've got the memo, and if they think there's anything legally incorrect in the memo, or if they want to engage in a dialogue and ask any questions on that call, they're welcome to join us. I don't see any reason not to do that. I see Mary's hand up.
Yes, thanks, Phil, and thanks, George. We can certainly write to Thomas Schneider along the lines that you've just outlined, Phil, about next week's call following confirmation from Professor Swain that he will indeed be available. To George's question about whether we'll be getting anything in writing, I think that's something that staff will seek a reply from Prof. Swain about, since he hasn't actually seen these comments and questions. So it may well be that he either is in a position to provide written comments to some, if not all, of those questions and perhaps choose to answer others on the call, or he may choose to first engage on the call and provide written follow-up shortly thereafter. But certainly we will check that with him. Thanks.
Yeah. Thank you, Mary. And I think for the call next week, you know, I don't know if it's realistic to expect the professor to answer any of these observations or questions in writing in the coming 7 days. But I think, you know, with the my view is that the professor comes away from receipt of these questions and observations and decides that he wants to rephrase anything in the memo based on them and the discussion next week. He should be free to before we deem it a final enclosed document, but that we should not be asking him to change anything. I think for the integrity of the process, any additional changes should be on his own volition and not as a request of a demand of this working group. Because as George points out, it's his report, his name's on it, and we can read it and take what we wish from it as a working group. That's our part of the deal. All right, so thank you all for participating today. I hope you found the call useful in furthering your own understanding of the legal memo, and we hope we have better turnout next week, and we'll have staff emphasize to all the members of the working group that next week will be a very important call. It will be our one and only opportunity to engage, not face-to-face, but one-on-one working group to professor with the author of the memo and raise questions and comments about it. So thank you all, and enjoy the rest of your day. Bye-bye.
Bye, everybody.